Well, good evening, everybody. Good to see you here tonight. We're going to be, you guessed it, in Daniel tonight, all right? So we're going to try our best to take a look here at Daniel chapter 11, the whole chapter, which sometimes that doesn't mean much, but tonight that is a lot of verses. So we're going to do this tonight, hopefully in one shot. And the reason why is because it's mainly a historical account that is unfolded to Daniel of all the things that are going to happen in the days to come, the near future. Now, why I say historical account, I mean historical account to us. To Daniel, this is Gabriel's proclamation that God gave to Gabriel to pass on to Daniel about the things that were going to come in the days ahead. So all of this from Gabriel to Daniel is predictive. It's future-looking. To us, though, it is history. And so it's an interesting study in how this works. Also, you're going to see as we work through this, there is a lot that has hints and has foreshadows towards things that are to come. All right. So in chapter 10, verse 1, there is talk about this conflict that is coming. And it's primarily between Persia and between Greece, like we've been seeing here. There's four main nations in view in the book of Daniel. You've got Babylon, you've got Persia, you've got Greece, and then you've got a hint at Rome. Okay. So these are the four main nations in view. And again, this is because of the time period that Daniel lived and ministered in. God was telling him what was going to happen in the current people that he began with. That was Babylon. God told him what was going to happen in the uprising of Persia, which Daniel also lived and ruled in. And then he also tells him what's going to come after this. All right, so that's why these four nations are in view. But this chapter and the chapter before and the chapter after are primarily focused in on two nations, Persia and Greece. All right, and so this is where we stand. Understand, though, this is a significant chapter because you and I can go back here tonight, and I'm going to do this in very sparse details, but you could get very detailed in this and show how line after line after line after line after line of Daniel, the prophecy, the prediction that was given to him, future looking, has come to pass in history now. It's amazing when you stop and think about the level of detail and the level of things that Gabriel told to Daniel so that he would understand what was to come. How much of that we can look back now and say, that happened, and that happened, and that happened, and that happened, and that happened. It's really astonishing, honestly. And it's part of the reason why some people, not me, look at this section of Daniel saying, Daniel obviously didn't write this. This was written later on after everything happened. And they just wrote down a history of things. No, this is future looking, okay? And if you were to read a handful of commentaries, you'll run across several that will tell you Daniel was written after the fact. It's like a historical memento. No, this was future looking. God revealed these things to Daniel, and this is what makes it so amazing. So look at chapter 11 with me. We're going to pick up in verse 2 here tonight. And this is Gabriel speaking to Daniel, right? And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, there are three more kings that will arise in Persia, and the fourth will be far richer than them all. And by his strength, through his riches, he will stir up against all the realm of Greece, and the mighty king will arise who will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom will be uprooted even for others beside these. All right, so I put up there on the screen an overview here. Daniel has now been given word about the rise and the fall of Babylon. Remember the hand that wrote on the wall? Daniel understood what was going on with that. And now he's being told of how the lifespan of Persia and the rise of the next kingdom. So this is an amazing thing. I mean, just when you pan back and think about this. This is one man that was an exile, was made a eunuch, or not an exile, but he was carried away into bondage into Babylon. He was made a eunuch. And all of these events of history, God used this one man to reveal truth to. It's really amazing. You think about the rise and fall of nations and both things to come and things that happened in his life and things to come in the far future all came through this one man who was a messenger. Right? It's really kind of astonishing to think about the center point that this guy has and that God used him to be a voice piece for us to hear. So what he says here to him is this. There's going to be three more kings in Persia until a fourth king rises up that's going to be stronger than all of them. And his strength will come by riches, and he, though, will stir up the realm of Greece. He's going to become so mighty, so rich, so powerful, that Greece is going to have to do something about it. Now, if you put that map up there for me, Brett, Just so you know, if you were to look at the Hebrew text here, it actually doesn't say Greece, it says Javan or Javan. If you notice up there, you got Shem, Ham, and Japheth. You remember who they belong to, right? Noah, right? These are his boys. So if you notice up there in the north part, you've got the descendants of Gomer and Javan, the sons of Japheth. And you notice there in Greece, it says Javan, okay? Javan is the Hebrew word that's used here. So we're talking primarily about people from that area. And from a Hebrew recollection, from the Hebrew mind, the Hebrew ears, they're not thinking Greece like we think today, although it is Greece like we think of it today. They hear Javan and they think Japheth. Okay, they think this is one of the descendants, one of the three descendants of Noah, and that's still the name that is recorded that is here. Now, when you come back to the text here, you'll notice here he says that three more kings are going to rise, a fourth one will be far richer than all, and this will stir everything up. And that's exactly what happened, actually. There were four kings from the time that Daniel wrote this until Greece defeated Persia at the Battle of Marathon. And you can read about that in history if you want. 490 BC, this happened, but that's not the whole story. And this is one of those areas where I've made mention before, I'm going to probably make mention of a couple other times tonight. We often look at history or prophecy as like a two-dimensional square, okay? When in fact, history is actually a three-dimensional cube, all right? We look at it on one plane, right? You've got a two-dimensional square like everybody can draw, and then if I said draw a cube, it gets a little trickier for some people, right? So that becomes, drawing things in three dimensions becomes a little trickier, but it's not until you see things in three dimensions that you get the full picture. So if you read here in the text, it seems two-dimensional, like there's going to be three kings, and then a fourth king, and then Greece will rise up, and then a mighty king will come, and this whole thing will change. But actually what happens in terms of history is this. There are four kings, and then there's this battle at Marathon where Greece defeats Persia, but Persia still has power for another 160 years. Okay, so when it says here in verse 3, then a mighty king will arise who will reign with great dominion, that king that we're talking about is none other than Alexander the Great. But there's a period of time that elapses from when these four kings rise up and Greece and Persia do battle to the time when this great king rises up, and it's about a 160-year period of time. And this is when Alexander will defeat Darius III, and that will occur in about 331 BC if we look back out on history. And this vision correlates with the one we saw back in Daniel chapter 8. You got the ram and the goat that were doing war, and the one had the big mighty horn, and as soon as he won, it says that his horn fell off and he lost all of his power. And that's what I mentioned to you before. That's what happened to Alexander, right? Alexander rose to power very, very quickly on the shoes of his dad, Philip of Macedon. He had this massive kingdom, and like I told you before, the guy was a raging alcoholic, died in his 30s. Okay, he had all of this huge power, and then it was all gone. And they divided up his kingdom into, like it says here, the four winds of heaven, into four directions. Okay, so, but understand here, like when you see this overview in verses 2 through 4, that this seems very two-dimensional. Like, there's going to be three kings, and then a fourth great king, and there's going to be this war, and then from that war, a great king will arise. But there's actually a large period of time, right? If you were living in the days of the Battle of Marathon, you'd think, this is it. This is it. This is where the great king is going to rise up, and this is going to be, but actually, another 160 years elapsed. And I tell you that for a couple reasons. One, because it helps us keep us humble when we study biblical prophecy. Like, read the Old Testament, and I've mentioned this before. How many of you read through the Old Testament and find that Jesus is going to come, he's going to live, he's going to die, he's going to go back to heaven, then he's going to wait a couple of thousand years before he comes back? It seems very two-dimensional, like he's going to come, and when he comes, he's going to rule, right? He's going to be king, he's going to be mighty, he's going to set up dominion and power and glory, he's going to set up this kingdom of which will never, ever end, he's going to make the lion lay down with the lamb, and when in fact, that's the two-dimensional look at it, when you look at it in three dimensions, God had something else in mind. And now, with a couple thousand years of history behind us, we're like, oh, that's what God was talking about. Okay. Same thing is to be said here in terms of this. The other reason I tell you that is that I would caution you, keep looking for the end. We're told to do that. Be expectant, be ready, be watching. But also remember the things that we see in two-dimensional characteristics often have a three-dimensional shape. It might seem right now like the world has to come to an end. Seriously, Pastor, have you watched the news? I try not to, okay? You should probably try not to also, but you think about Israel as a nation, and you got Russia coming down, you got Iran coming up, and it's like, whoa, it's got to be happening right now. Maybe. right? If it happens now, I'll be the first to say, man, all the handwriting was right on the wall, right? But I just remind you that we look at things in two dimensions when it's actually in three dimensions, okay? This may very well be it. I would just, some of you are old enough that you have lived through this. I can't attest to this, but what was it like when Israel became a nation in 1948? I mean, everybody in the world must have been like, the end of the world is here. The world is at war. They're coming from the north and the south and the east and the west, and Israel's a nation again. And now we're plus how many years? The end of the world still hasn't come yet, right? So you know what I'm saying? Like, it seems like it's all makes perfect sense in two dimensions until you look at it in three dimensions. And a passage like this is a perfect example of this, where it seems like three kings and then a fourth and then a battle and then a great king rises up when there's actually a implied gap. Period of time that takes place here, and the Lord knew that. It's not like it was a surprise, but when we look at it this way, we just need to be reminded of that. And that's how biblical prophecy works. It seems concrete until you have a few years under your belt, until you see the full working and the full plan of God. Persia was defeated at Marathon, but that wasn't the end of their kingdom, that wasn't the end of their dominion. Alexander did rise into power. He was this one great mighty king in verse 3. His kingdom was immediately divided into four parts, and we'll talk about that more here in just a minute, but there is a period of time that unfolds here over verses 2 through 4 that is not necessarily easily seen in what is happening here until you have a little bit of time. Now, what's interesting then next about this prophecy is all the details that God gives to Gabriel, and Gabriel passes on to Daniel. Daniel has been praying and fasting and searching and studying God's word and repenting of his sins and sins of his people, and God wants him to know all this. And the amount of detail that God gives to Daniel is quite amazing. All right, so rather than explaining all of it, I'm just going to read it in chunks for you, and I'll make a few comments of things I think that might be helpful or interesting to you. I'm by no means going to lay out all the details because that would take way too long, okay? And it would become a little bit tedious. There are so many resources out there. If you want to read verse by verse and see the historical figures alluded to in every verse, by all means, you can do that. I can point you in the right direction. But I want to give you the kind of big picture overview of what is happening here. So, second thing here, these unfolding events. Okay, so notice in verse 5, let's look through verses 5 through 8, and I'll make a couple of comments here. Also, the king of the south will become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he will gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion. At the end of some years, he will join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she will not retain any of her power of authority, neither he of his authority will stand, but she will be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with strengthened and him who strengthened her in those times. But a branch from her roots, one will arise in his place, who will come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he will also carry their gods captive to Egypt, and their princes, and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he will continue more years than the king of the north. Now let's just pause right there. Brett, you got another map to put up there, okay? You can see here, this is what happens. When Alexander died, the kingdom of Greece was broken up into four parts, okay? And the two that we're interested in here for the sake of our time here tonight are the big green blob and the big red-orangish blob, okay? The reddish-orange blob is the kingdom of Ptolemy. That was the guy, and it became all of these Ptolemies that ruled in his place. And then the one, the big green one there is the Seleucids, all right? Now, when we read here in verses 5 through 8, we talk about the king of the south and the king of the north. We are talking about Seleucia and the Ptolemies is what we're talking about, all right? When you bear all this stuff out here, the king of the north are the Seleucids and the king of the south are the Ptolemies, all right? So where we look at the Ptolemaic kingdom, like it says up there, primarily think like Egypt, okay? That's the main region we're talking about. We talk about the Seleucids, we're talking like the southern part of what we would call Turkey, and then all the way out into Syria, Iraq, Iran, and depending on the map that you look at, the Seleucid Empire went close all the way over to India, which you can see on the very far right, you see the Indus River, which is part of India. Okay, so you got a huge kingdom, and from the Seleucids, the armies of the north, and the armies of the south, these are the two that we're primarily talking about. So the king of the south and the king of the north, these are the ones. The king of the south, the daughter that is referred to here in this text, is a lady named Bernice, and she was married off to Antiochus II, who was a Seleucid, all right? And for some reason, Antiochus thought, he could divorce his wife, it would be no big deal, and marry another girl. That's a bad idea, okay? Because what happens is he gets rid of his wife and marries Bernice from the south. The king from the south is trying to make inroads into the king of the north, and so he says, here's my daughter, let's get married, let's make a union. They think this is all going to work really good, but in order to do that, Antiochus II, from up there north part, has to get rid of his wife. That did not go well, okay? Bernice and Antiochus II have kids, and the ex-wife gets nasty, like downright nasty. She kills off her ex-husband. She kills off the wife. She kills off the kid, okay? Somewhere along the way, though, one of the kids survives and escapes. It's one of those providential moments here because you notice in verse 7, a branch of her roots will arise in his place, and that happens, okay? One of Bernice's kids survives the crazy ex-wife and survives and actually does become a ruler. But this is what it happens here. And you can read all about this history in the secular textbooks. Some of you were in a science class did a couple weeks ago, and I said the Apocrypha has some helpful information in it. Most of this is actually recorded in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Okay, so some of this stuff is there too. Again, not scripture, but it is relevant history as to what happened between Malachi and the coming of Jesus. Okay, so some of this stuff is just written down, and you can read about it in secular history or there. Now, that all takes place in that first period. Now, let's keep going in verse 9. Okay, so when we talk king of the north, we're talking the Seleucids, Antiochus, think Antioch, okay, that area of Syria up there. And we talk about the kings of the south, we're talking, think Egypt, think the Ptolemies, okay, and there's going to be this constant warring, and you can read about this in history too. The Grecian Empire was never strong after Alexander because there was all this infighting between the four different regions within Greece. And most of it was between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And that's why the kingdom never achieved the greatness that it did under Alexander, because there's all this constant bickering, right? A house divided, can't stand against itself, right? That's the idea. So even if you're reading about the Grecian Empire and its power and might and everything, that's true to some degree. But within the empire, you got this going on, and the Lord is telling all of this to Daniel before any of it ever come to pass. All right, so this continues on this way. All right, this verse 9 through 19 is this unfolding war between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, between the north and the south. Okay, verse 9 says this: the king of the north shall come into the kingdom of the king of the south, but he will not return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a great multitude of forces. One will certainly come and overwhelm them and pass through them, and he will return to his fortress and stir up strife. Then, and the king of the south will be moved with rage and go out to fight with him, with the king of the north, who will muster a great multitude, and the multitude will be given into the hand of his enemy. And when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now, in those times shall arise up a king of the south. Also, a violent man of your people will come, exalting themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they will fall. So the king of the north shall come and build siege mounts and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south will not withstand him. Even his choice troops will have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He will stand in the glorious land, Israel, with destruction in his power. And he will set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and the upright ones with him, thus he shall do. And he will give him his daughter, he shall give him rather the daughter of women to destroy it, but she will not stand with him or before him. After this, he will turn his face to the coastlands, and he will take many, but the ruler will bring reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he will turn his face towards the fortress of his own land, but will stumble and fall and not be found. All right, let me pause there and explain a couple of things. This is the war between the north and the south. Not the civil war here in our country, between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. In verse 11 and following, the chief king is Antiochus III, who is a Seleucid, all right? And in verse 17, you'll notice here that there talks about this daughter of women. And what happens here is that Antiochus, because of his own inability to fight, which is kind of talked about in the prophecy that's given, he's forced to sign a treaty with the king of the south, that is the Ptolemies, and he gave his daughter, hoping that his daughter would influence his standing there, right? This is kind of how it worked in the ancient world. If you've read any world history, if you want to have a pact with another country, you send them a daughter, right? And marry them off and make an uneasy alliance kind of a thing. And we saw this with Bernice. Here again, this happens here. However, in this case, the opposite happened as the text predicts. The text says that she will not stand with him. This is what happened, okay? Antiochus III sends his daughter down south, hoping that it'll give him a foothold, give him a place of authority in the south. What actually happened is she got down there, and she's like, I love the Ptolemies! And she completely got involved with them and became one of them and became a chief supporter of the Ptolemies. So this is his betrayal that's talked about here. Okay, her name will catch your ear, but I do need to clarify, her name was Cleopatra, but not that Cleopatra, okay? The Cleopatra you're probably thinking of with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony came many, many, many years later. But this was the first of Seleucid queens who bore the name Cleopatra, of which one would come many years later with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. Okay, that's all part of this. But she's the first Cleopatra in a line of Cleopatras that would come out of this empire. Okay, so when it talks about this king trying to war and failing over and over and over again, we're talking about this king, and we're talking about this daughter that he brings. And eventually he, despite all of his best efforts, can't do anything. He can't fight against it, and the Ptolemies come into power. Now, verse 20, this is what it says. They shall arise in his place, one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. And again, wherever we see the glorious kingdom or the glorious land, we're talking about Israel. But within a few days, he will be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. Okay, so let me just pause there. Antiochus III, he had a successor whose name was Seleucus IV. He immediately sent a tax collector to Jerusalem to try to gain wealth for Syria so they could muster their forces and go do war with the Ptolemies. Now, if you just become king, sending a tax collector to all your provinces, is that a good move or a bad move? Bad move, right? Not good, right? It's like, we don't like seeing the tax collector come now, let alone if there's a change in leadership and he's like, more taxes! This tax collector was so bad, in fact, he was operating under the rules of this Seleucus IV. He decided also, not only am I going to tax people heavy, I'm going to the temple, and I'm going to demand that they give me the stuff in the temple because I need more money, and there's money in the temple, which did not go over well, as you can imagine. He did not get anything, and in fact, if you read in 2 Maccabees, the reason he didn't get anything on the temple was because angels stopped him. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. Okay, it may be more myth than anything else, but the reason he didn't get into the temple and take their stuff was because angels stopped him, according to Jewish history as to how that unfolded. Now, what it says here in the text, if you notice in verse 20, within a few days he will be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. And that's exactly what happened. Now, days meaning months rather than literal days, okay, but it was a very, 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 very short period of time. Most people think, in terms of history, that this guy whose name Heliodorus was the tax collector's name. Most people think he killed off the king in an attempt to take power. He saw this vacuum of power. He's the one who's now got the money bags from all the taxes he collected. And so most people think he poisoned him, killed him, or paid a hitman kind of person to take him out. This is the kind of dysfunction that's happening. And if you've read any world history of these long-term kingdoms, you realize this kind of dysfunction is totally normal. If you haven't read any world history, you've read the history of Israel in the Bible. Same kind of dysfunction, right? Same kind of dysfunction amongst the kings of Israel. All right, this is a common thing that repeats itself over and over and over and over again in the history of the world. Now, when we pick up in verse 21, there is a new king that comes into place. And this is the guy who you've probably, if you've heard the name Antiochus before, this is the guy that you've heard of. Antiochus IV, who he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes, meaning I am the manifestation of God, or God in your presence, okay? He labeled himself that. Nobody else called him that, because this dude was a bad hombre, okay? But this is what he named himself, and these verses in 21 and following talk then about this Antiochus that rises up later. Verse 21, this is where we pick up. In his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood, they will be swept away before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made, he shall act deceitfully, and he will come up and become strong with a small number of people. He will enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he will do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers, and he will disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he will divide his plans among the strongholds, but only for a time. He will stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south will be stirred up in battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat the portions of his delicacies will destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts will be bent on evil, and they will speak lies at the same table, but it will not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart will be moved against the Holy Covenant, and so he will do damage and return to his own land. So let's talk here for a couple minutes about what's going on here. One of the features that maybe caught your ear is this word covenant. It comes up two different times. Once it talks about a prince of a covenant. Once it talks about a holy covenant or the people of a holy covenant. And we got to keep them separate for the sake of understanding what is happening here. Okay, this is one of those places where we begin to see that this prophecy is not necessarily two-dimensional, but we begin to see the two-dimensional square start to turn. See, there's a lot more dimension here than what's going on, right? Because with Antiochus, not only is there a historical figure being predicted, but Antiochus is widely known and believed to be a foreshadowing or a type of an Antichrist that is to come. And this is where these historical prophecies begin to have both a fulfillment now in terms of world history that's already come to pass, and you begin to see hints and overtones and aromas of things that are to come. We'll see this a little bit later in this chapter. We begin to hear about an abomination of desolation, something that happened once and something that will happen again. But in this Antiochus guy, we begin to see some of this. Now, the prince of the covenant that is made mention of in verse 21, you hear that stuff, and if you were paying attention a couple weeks ago, one of the very first things the Antichrist is going to do to finish off that, start that 70th week of Daniel, is make a covenant. And you're like, oh, covenant, prince of covenant, this sounds like it all lines up, okay? And this is where there's hints and there's overtones of this. But the prince of the covenant actually is somebody that Antiochus made a peace agreement with. He made covenant with, okay? He is the one, his name was actually Ptolemy VI, and Antiochus made a covenant between the two of them. And this was in order to have this uneasy alliance to give Antiochus a little bit of room to breathe so that way he didn't get taken out. However, the other mention of covenant in verse 28, this is something that you need to pay attention to because this word, or rather phrase, is going to keep popping up through the rest of the chapter. And that is when you read against the Holy Covenant, we're talking about the nation of Israel. Okay, they are considered by many, and here in the context, they are the Holy Covenant. They are this covenant people that God has set apart and made holy, made separate. So when he says here that he's going to move against the Holy Covenant at the end of verse 28 and do damage to them and then return to his own land, this is what's being talked about. Antiochus is going to do evil things that his forefathers had never done before. And part of that is going to be violence done against the Holy Covenant, and that's going to be en route to his home. Now, Brett, if you can go back to that map for just a second. I don't know if you can read this or see it or not, but remember, Ptolemies are in the south, okay? Antioch is up there. Can you guys see Antioch? It's right where the bend of the green thing is at, up there just south of Asia Minor. If you can't see it, that's okay. But Antioch is part of the place where Antiochus reigned, and he has to go right through Israel to get to his homeland, right? And this is part of what's being talked about. On his way back to the north, he is definitely doing bad stuff to the nation of Israel, some of which we'll talk about here in just a minute. So what kind of stuff did he do against the Holy Covenant? When he has these problems with the Ptolemies and he is trying to figure out what he's going to do, he takes out a lot of his wrath and his rage on the people of the Holy Covenant. And this is what happens in verse 29. At the appointed time, he will return and go towards the south, but it will not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus will come against him, therefore he will be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant to do damage. He's going to go to war, and it's not going to be like the times before or the times after, but his response to this attack is going to be to do war with the Holy Covenant, that is, with Israel. Middle of verse 30. So he will return and show regard for those who forsake Holy Covenant. That is for those that forsake or speak out against those that do harm to Israel, he's going to show regard to them. He's going to show favor to those that harm or forsake or abandon the Holy Covenant that is Israel. And verse 31, and forces will be mustered by him, and they will defile the sanctuary fortress, and they will take away the daily sacrifices, and place there an abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he will corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God will be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand will instruct many, yet for many days will fall by sword and flame and captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they will be aided with a little help, but many will join them by intrigue, and some of those by all understanding will fall, to refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Then the king will do according to his own will. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak blasphemies against God of gods and will prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. All right, so we see here some of the predictions of Antiochus the Fourth's evil work. He will praise people that do harm to Israel. He will cut off the sacrificial system. In other words, he's not going to allow people to make sacrifice in the temple. And he's going to do worse than that. He's going to do something worse than anybody had ever done, and that is he's going to offer an abomination of desolation, which in historical terms is Antiochus went in and offered a pig on the altar of God to Zeus. Okay, he went in and offered an unclean animal in an unclean way to a false god in Jerusalem's temple. Now, why God didn't strike him down is beyond me. Okay, you read about some of the Aaron's boys who decided they were going to act out in ungodly ways, and God struck them down or swallowed them up. Okay, you read about other people like that. And why God didn't do this is because of, mostly the answer is because there was still stuff more for Antiochus to do. But to think about the, you know, from a holy perspective, to look and say, God, why? Why would you allow this to take place? It's kind of mind-boggling, right? Because it was a total abomination of everything that was going to happen. However, in saying that, you're like, wait, abomination of desolation, right? I know about that. Jesus talked about that, right? That's in Daniel chapter 12, and this got talked about back in Daniel chapter 9 too, and this is where I'm saying, like, this becomes very three-dimensional at this point. This is no longer just like history being prophesied. There is a lot going on here, and this is why Antiochus is viewed as a sort of proto-antichrist. He's like a hint at what is to come. Now, this would also be one of those points where I tell you, okay, that for those that do not view a physical kingdom of Jesus to come, those that do not view, a rapture, something that the Bible teaches, I disagree with them. But if you want to know, like, how do they get to such an occasion? They say that all of the things that Daniel predicted came to pass before the days of Jesus, and this is how they get there, okay? They're not fools. All right, but they disagree. We disagree on some major areas of teaching. But they would say, look, there's an abomination of desolation predicted. There's an abomination of desolation that comes. And then Jesus comes and reigns as king. Right? So they would say this is how it works. And you're like, Pastor, that's so crazy. How in the world could they ever believe that? Well, it's because they're taking a different angle on the interpretation of what Daniel teaches. And there's a reason for it. I just disagree. Okay, and that's not the position that we're going to take here in the church, but if you want to know why, that's because they would view all this stuff that we see here as having a singular fulfillment rather than two fulfillments. Okay, that's in the very briefest way I can say that. That's how that works. Okay, one of the reasons I object to that, though, is because of the fact of what Jesus taught us. Okay, if you remember what Jesus said, or if you want to look ahead on your own time to Matthew chapter 24, his disciples near the end of the time when he's approaching to go to the cross, they asked him and said, Jesus, how will we know when the times and seasons of the end of the world are about to come about? And one of the very first things that Jesus tells them is for those that understand the prophecy of Daniel, and then he gives a whole long discourse. Okay? In other words, why I say that I disagree with those that take that historical only view of this chapter is that Jesus didn't view it as historical only. Jesus viewed it as future. And he said, when the disciples asked them, how do we know what will be the signs? And how will we know when the end of the world is coming? How will we know when the kingdom is coming down? And all this kinds of stuff that they were looking forward to. He said, go look at Daniel, because Daniel tells you what's going to happen in the future. Okay? that if you want a simple reason as to why this is not just a historical allusion, while there's both historical things and prophetic, it's because Jesus tells us so, all right? So if you're trying to figure out and sort that out in your head, that's like the biggest key that I hold on to in my brain, is Jesus said this stuff is yet to come. And yet we can also say some of it has come to pass because history records it for us. And it's a testimony to the wisdom and the power of who God is. Now, what happens next is a matter of debate amongst many, okay? When you pick up in verse 36, where we left off, all right? And I read verse 36, this king will do according to his own will. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak blasphemies against the God of gods and will prosper until the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. All right? This verse and the verses that follow down through verse 45 are a matter of debate, okay? Some people view verses 36 through 45 as referring to what Antiochus did. Okay, it's a further elaboration on Antiochus, his depravity, his wickedness, all this other kinds of stuff. A lot of other people, myself included, view verses 36 and following to be a hint as to what Antichrist will be and what he will do. But the biggest reason for that, and what I'll just tell you up front before I read it for you, is this. It says here, we'll get to it in a minute when I read it, is that this king, this man who's going to rise up, dies in Israel. Okay? So he's going to nestle himself between the coastlands and between the hills of Jerusalem, and there's where he's going to die. History records unanimously that Antiochus died in Persia, nowhere near Israel. Okay, and that's one of the reasons why I feel like this hints at something else. Plus, some of the stuff that are recorded here might allude to Antiochus, but history doesn't record him actually doing some of these things. Okay, so both some of the historical allusions and also the fact of the place of his death both lead me to believe that verse 36 and following are looking ahead at another the type that is to come, right, of who Antiochus is foreshadowing. So this is what is said then. I'll pick up reading in verse 37 because I already read verse 36. He will neither regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor any God, for he will exalt himself above them all. But in their place he will honor a god of fortresses, a god which his fathers did not know. He will honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. And he will act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god. And he will acknowledge and advance its glory and shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. At the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he will enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. And he will also enter into the glorious land, and many countries will be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He will stretch out his hands against the countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. And they will have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels, but news from the east and the north will trouble him. Therefore he will go out with great fury to destroy and to annihilate many, and he will plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will come to help him. As I said, I think most of this stuff alludes to something that is yet to come. Not only because of historical things related to here, but most notably how he dies in verse 45. And this is akin to what you read in the book of Revelation, that the Antichrist, at the end when it's all over, he's not going to be able to stand. Why? Because he's doing battle with the Lord Jesus Christ himself. There's going to be nobody that can help him, despite the fact that the armies will be mustered and they will try to come and help and everything else, they will not stand. And we know from Revelation that there's going to be a global battle here at the end of the 7-year, the 70th week of Daniel. It's going to take place. And nations from the kingdoms from the north and the south and the east and the west are all going to do war with the king. And Jesus is going to win. Right, so this is, again, it's a matter of debate. It's split pretty much 50-50 down the line, depending on how you want to look at it. But that is what is going on. Now, how are we to think about this whole chapter? Well, a couple of things, all right? One is the fact that this continues into chapter 12, and we'll get there next week, I think. But where I just want to end for tonight is this. I just want you to consider the magnitude of what was just told to Daniel. I know there's a lot of world history. Some of it might be foreign to you. That's fine. But he just told him, essentially, everything that's going to happen in terms of some major details and some minor details of how the next 400 years of world history is going to unfold before it ever happens. You realize that, how significant that is? Like, just stop and think, right? Like, how many of you know what you're going to do tomorrow right now? Right? I mean, you think about the details of life. I mean, you might have a plan, but then tomorrow happens, you never know what's going to happen, right? If you think about all the details of our lives, all the things that we forget, we think about everything that's going to take place, that may or may not take place, and it's just impossible for us to say what's going to happen between now and next Sunday night when we gather. God has just revealed to Daniel the next 400 years of world history. And you just have to stand back, and apart from having your brain be a little numb and foggy, right, just say, man, God is awesome. Like, who can do this? Who can have this kind of knowledge to know exactly what's going to come? Even to the point that he knows that this lady's going to have her kids killed off, but one's going to survive, and this king's going to send his daughter down to get married. I mean, all the fine details about the types of battle and the locations of the battles and all the other stuff that I didn't tease out in this passage. I mean, God knew all of that and told it all to Daniel in advance. Not only that, he also gave him strong words to come about the great tribulation. In chapter 12, he's going to talk about the resurrection of the dead to life and the resurrection of the dead to everlasting contempt, something that Jesus is going to quote and talk about, and we'll deal with that next week. He also told him about the very end of things that are to come in the world that have not even yet come. And in that sense, he's still telling Daniel 2,400 years worth of world history and counting. You have to stand back here and consider the fact of the knowledge and the power and the wisdom of God. When we say, or we sing, how great is our God, right? We think, how great is he to save us? We think, how great is he to provide for our needs? How great is he to heal us from our sicknesses? We think, how great is he to answer the prayers for the needs of our heart? But I would ask you to think a little bit bigger about how great is our God. Think about, we say that his wisdom is beyond finding out. And we talk about how his power is beyond what anybody can think or imagine. We think about the magnitude of the wisdom and the power and the authority of God, that he can not only know everything that's going to happen, but he can give it in specific detail hundreds of years before it happens. And then he's never wrong. Right? This past scripture, just like, man, there's so many details and so much tedious stuff. If you forget everything I said, I don't care. What I want you to remember is this. Our God is awesome. God's in control, right? All of this is, God says, I know what's going to happen. You want me to tell you a little bit about it? Okay. Tell you about it in more detail than you care to know, probably. And it all came to pass. Here's the thing. We need to continue to trust in who our God is. This is the one that we get to call Father. This is the one who saw us in our sin, who saw us in our rebellion against him and said, despite the fact that you're in sin, I'm going to send my son to die for you. Right? And even bigger than this, in terms of what God's doing here, this is not just like a little mini history lesson about two kings. This is God preparing the stage and setting all of the world on a course that it would be ready and the perfect season of time for Jesus to come and die on the cross for us. Right? Galatians, Paul writes that in due time, at just the right moment, in the fullness of time is the phrase he uses, Jesus came born of a virgin, right? These are all of the world events that took place, and God was saying, I'm going to make this happen, and this happen, and this happen, and this happen, and this happen, so that when Jesus comes here, it's going to be just perfectly fitted for whatever is happening. And all these events are leading up to the coming of Jesus. All these events are leading to our redemption, and all of them are ultimately for the glory of God. Everything is from him, and through him, and to him, right? And passages like these, I know, sometimes can be tedious, but I would just encourage you to let a passage like this lead you to worship. Say, who is a God like our God? Like the Old Testament writes over and over again. I mean, who is like him? I can't remember where my car keys are someday. I came here to church tonight, and I got here, and it's like, oh, forgot my key card. Good thing I got a master key to go walk around the back of the building and let myself in. And God just says, hey, look, here's 400 years worth of world history. I'll just tell you all of it, just enough to let you know I'm still the boss, right? This is who our God is. God is doing so many good things. And I know right now the world can be kind of scary. I know the world can be kind of evil. I know the world can be very discouraging and depressing, and you're like, what in the world is God doing right now? And let me just remind you, God's got the whole thing under control. Remember the little kid's song? He's got the whole world in his hands. Right? Remember that song? Well, don't forget it, because it's still true. It's still true. He's got you and me, baby, right, in his hands. This is the truth. And these verses here, although maybe tedious, are a reminder that God knows what happens before, and he ensures that his perfect will comes about in time, and everything that he's predicted yet to come will most definitely come true. And that means for us, Jesus is preparing a place for us right now, and if he goes to prepare a place, he's definitely coming back for us. And in the end, Jesus conquers over evil, he conquers over Antichrist, over every vile thing he conquers, and he will have a perfect and abiding kingdom on this earth for all of eternity. Right, that's our hope. God knows all this. So again, if you forget all the details about all the Ptolemies and Seleucids, I don't care. Just remember that we have a great God. He knows what he's doing. He knows what's happening before it ever happens. It's all written out into his mind just like it was a book that he can read out to us. This is the God that we serve. Father, we thank you for being in control of everything. We thank you for this little glimpse into your power and your foreknowledge and your insight and how we can stand, thankfully, on this side of history and see all the ways that you were right. There's never a question as to whether you'll be right or not, but we can stand here and worship and rejoice in the fact of how good you really are. God, we ask that you would come, that we might see you, that we might behold you, that wickedness would be put down and that righteousness would be lifted up, that we would see you on your throne in the city of Jerusalem. God, we long to see that so much. We long to be with you so that we can be like you. And we ask that that would come soon. But while we wait, we ask for the ability to worship and the ability to walk in faith and for the ability to see you for who you really are. God, give us a big vision of who you are, a big view of your power and wisdom and authority, and that we would not lose heart, but that we would walk in faithfulness with you. We ask now for your help for this new week that you've given to us. Help us to be strong in the faith, to walk in love, and as you told Micah, that we would do justly, and that we would love mercy, and that we would walk humbly with you. And we pray this in your name.